Nukes and fire. With the horrific wildfires still burning out of control in Los Angeles, more than a week after they started, the question has been asked, are there any nuclear sites being threatened by the fires? And what if a fire on the magnitude of the Palisades or Eaton fires bore down on a nuclear reactor? How dangerous would that be? To find out, I spoke with several genuine experts on nuclear vulnerabilities, and one of them said,
even when they're shut down, nuclear reactors have to be babied. They have to be supported by the rest of society. And if the rest of society can't do that, then crises develop over time, depending on the situation. So it's not direct, you know, it's not heat. It's the loss of the power lines, the substations, and so forth.
And there's so much more to it. Well, when Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group points out the ultimate vulnerability of nuclear reactors on the ground and is joined by other experts pointing out problems fire poses to nukes, you get a clear picture of how at risk we really are when fire threatens that technology responsible for the awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevy. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at 3 Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a Nuclear Hot Seat special on nukes and fires. What are the dangers? The topics range from the difference between a line fire and a mass fire, hazards to spent fuel pools and fuel storage containers, how Southern California Edison retains a flawed system on its transmission towers that may have contributed to the start of the Altadena-Pasadena-Eaton fire, radiation releases, and other nuclear dangers created by wildfires at nuclear sites. We hear from Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group, Donna Gilmore of San Onofre Safety, Professor Stephen Starr, former director of the Clinical Laboratory Science Program at the University of Missouri, and Linda Pence Gunter's evaluation, which makes the unavoidable climate change connection during her regular feature, the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. Today is Tuesday, January 14, 2025, and here is this week's Nuclear Hot Seat special, Nukes and Fire. Right now, as I record this, thousands of firefighters are still battling wildfires across 45 square miles of densely populated Los Angeles County. The Palisades fire, which began in the Pacific Palisades on January 7, has destroyed about 5,000 structures, covered more than 23,000 acres, and is at only 19% containment. The Eaton fire north of Pasadena-Altadena also began on January 7 and has destroyed or damaged around 7,000 structures. It burned over 14,000 acres and is at 47% containment. Thus far, it is known that 26 people died and many more are still missing. To give you a sense of scale of the event, the Great Chicago Fire burned 3 square miles and the San Francisco Fire of 1906 after the earthquake burned 4 square miles. The Palisades Fire has already burned over 25 square miles. The Altadena-Eaton Fire has burned over 18 square miles. And as of yesterday, when this was compiled, all of the fires in Los Angeles have burned over 56 square miles and continue to grow. By comparison, Manhattan is 22.82 square miles, and San Francisco is 46.87 square miles. This is big, it is unprecedented, and it isn't over. I am adjacent to the fire zone, but still safe, and will go into a few details, but not until the end of this report. As you might imagine, I have received numerous messages questioning whether any nukes have been at risk. To find out, I spoke with several experts to gain their insights. Our topics ranged more widely than I had anticipated, from the difference between a line fire and a mass fire, and why reporters must never evoke Hiroshima or Nagasaki as a comparison to the devastation of the fire here, fire hazards posed by exposed spent fuel pools and fuel storage canisters, how Southern California Edison retains a flawed power transmission system that may have contributed to the start of the Altadena-Pasadena-Eaton fire, radiation releases from fire in radioactive materials dump zones, and other nuclear dangers created by wildfires at nuclear sites. First, Greg Mello. He is executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, which works for nuclear disarmament, environmental protection, social justice, and economic sustainability. We spoke on Friday, January 11, 2025. Greg Mello, thank you so much for making time to be with us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby.
As we all know, there are wildfires ravaging the Los Angeles area. And there are some nuclear questions that have come up in connection with this that I would like to discuss with you. First of all, you are in New Mexico, not California, and that is our most nuclear-affected site. Some people who are extremely clueless refer to it as a nuclear sacrifice zone. What has been your experience of wildfires and nuclear sites?
Wildfire is a thing here in New Mexico as it is in Southern California. It has a little different character, but when the wind is blowing very hard, fires can be impossible to stop. And there was a gigantic fire, two gigantic fires in this century in Los Alamos, one of which burned a significant fraction of the Los Alamos community. There were almost 400 houses burned down, and about a third or maybe two-thirds of the terrain of Los Alamos National Laboratory was burned a little bit, at least, some heavily, some lightly. And because of the hot, high wind in the dry spring, where embers are thrown a mile ahead of the regular front of the fire, and the whole town was evacuated on a moment's notice, and there was a pitched battle at some of the nuclear facilities to keep the fire out. So that was successful, although a number of facilities were damaged.
I also understand that around Los Alamos, there are many places where nuclear waste, especially in the early days, was just dumped with no protection. Were they impacted at all by this? And was there any kind of record or examination or study done in the wake of it to find out exactly how contaminated the area might have become?
So there's sort of a light sprinkling of uranium, let's say, in some places, and some of that was volatilized. And then there's concentrated waste stored in some places. We were huddled. We flew over the fire four times in a rented airplane to try to follow the course of it and see how much danger there was, because the Department of Energy and the laboratory didn't know. And they were getting information from the news channels. The state government was getting information from us. And so we would huddle down with the state government and try to understand the nature of the danger. In the end, the vegetation wasn't thick enough to support a fire that could really burn up the nuclear waste. So it was close, but it was something that was successfully suppressed where there were stacks of drums. And since then, the vegetation has been cut back further. There's a certain amount of radiation in fallout from the Nevada test site, which is scattered everywhere. And so if you burn a forest down, you're going to get that. And so the smoke was just that little bit radioactive. And there were reports, anecdotal reports, of firefighters on the scene who were very freaked out by strange phenomena they saw. funny colors in the soil, most likely, pieces of metal burning. And because there's a lot of shrapnel from decades of open air testing, like there would be at Site 300 in Livermore. So it wasn't the nuclear part of that hazard of that fire wasn't so terrible. What we face going forward is that the laboratory is forested in places. You can't just cut off all the trees at the ground because they support endangered species. And so Los Alamos Lab remains in danger from forest fire, and the danger depends on the winds and on the moisture content. And it's still quite a danger, as laboratory documents say.
Lawrence O'Donnell, who's not somebody I usually follow, but I caught his report that what we're dealing with in Los Angeles is a hurricane without water, but with fire because of the winds, and that everything is at the affect of the winds. And only at the end of the report did he relate that the firefighters were staged only a couple of houses away from where his house was. And at that time, he didn't know if it was going to burn or not. So there was a great immediacy to that and an understanding of the profound nature of what it is we are facing here, because it's nowhere near contained.
We will return to that theme. Please keep, that's very apt, which we'll come back to it.
With these wildfires in Southern California, it's very personal to me, not only because of Southern California, but because the Eaton Fire, which is on the Pasadena Altadena matrix, has come to within about 7 miles of my home. And I've barely squeaked by being slightly outside, less than a mile outside of the be prepared to evacuate zone, that level of warning. I'm still in a warning zone, but it's kind of like the warning that comes before the warning. So today, Saturday, it's not as bad as it might be, but with the winds, we never know where it's going to go. As of today, the five biggest fires in Los Angeles, the most recent statistics we have, is that over 37,931 acres have burned. And in this area, the Eaton Fire, which is the one I'm closest to, as of this morning, it was 14,117 acres. This is a massive amount of area. I have heard on more than one occasion news reporters on radio, and I was driving my car, I couldn't write down who it was or what station, refer to the aftermath of this as quote unquote looking like Hiroshima, which I consider to be a tremendous overstatement and insult because of the different nature of the two levels of catastrophe. You made that point to me in one of our early email exchanges. What is the difference between what would happen in a nuclear explosion and what happens in a fire, even a fire of this magnitude?
Yes. Well, it's important we think about this right now because we have this, as terrible as it is, the fire also has an educational aspect. Maybe we can, locally, let's not build a bunch of flammable houses right next to each other where there's no place to stop the fire, for example. And in the case of a nuclear attack, what happens is that an extremely bright light from the nuclear explosion is created that releases about a trillion calories for every kiloton. And this light ignites everything at once that is flammable within a very large area. So those who plan nuclear attacks, they're attacking an aerial target like a city or an extensive military installation. They would use an airburst. So a large area of the city, let's say Los Angeles was attacked, a large area of the city would see that light, and that light would shine on it. And in the case of, let's take an 800 kiloton warhead, which is not an uncommon Russian warhead, 0.8 megaton, that would create, well, I guess the first thing to understand is that when everything burns all at once, it's very, very different than when a line of fire moves through, as in the case of all the fires that have just occurred. So almost every fire in US history has been a line fire. And there have only been a few mass fires, and they have been intentionally set during wartime. So Dresden, Hamburg, Nuremberg, Darmstadt, Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. So in those cases, large areas caught fire all at once. Some of it was just directly the light shining on it. In other cases, the buildings are knocked down or the internal walls of buildings knocked down, and then the flammable material inside the buildings catches fire. So in the case of an 800 kiloton airburst over downtown Los Angeles, we would expect the mass fire to extend to about 11 kilometers radius, which would be almost 100,000 acres, 94, 96,000 acres. And so it would be, let's say, three times the size of all these fires put together. But the effects would be quite different. So every single living thing inside that radius would die. There would be absolutely no chance of survival. They would die of being burned. The carbon monoxide in enclosed spaces from incomplete combustion killed many people in the cities mentioned. They just were baked out. It gets very hot in such a fire. Stirring the rubble, you know how you're in a fireplace, you stir the ashes and there's an ember in there. Well, they found that weeks later. In these German cities, they would stir the rubble to rebuild and are looking for survivors, and there'd be fires breaking out because it was still so hot. A gigantic bubble of superheated air would form, and it would rise very, very rapidly with hurricane speed, and winds would be blowing in toward the ground zero at hurricane force. And fanning the flames, people would be thrown into the air and carried by these winds, which would be a couple hundred miles an hour. And inside, once you got in the fire area, the wind would be 400 or 500 degrees, let's say. There would be what they found in the German cities was that firefighters, strong young persons, strong men, couldn't stand up. They had to crawl in the gutter. To away from the center of the fire to avoid being sucked into it because the winds are so strong that a person couldn't stand. There were people who were running from the fire in Dresden, and since the streets asphalt was melting, they would get stuck in the asphalt and they would burn up. And there was testimony from a British prisoner of war who saw some of this with his own eyes. So it's very different. It is a very different phenomenon. No survivors. So that would kill in Los Angeles approximately 2 million people just from the fire, not counting the radiation and the fallout.
You also made the point in something you sent to me that with a line fire, people have the ability to see it coming and get out of its way, which certainly we're having that information here as to evacuate now, get ready to evacuate, get ready to evacuate, which is the area that I am in. In a nuclear attack, there would be no such possibility. With a bomb going off, the fire that would result from that would be magnitudes beyond comprehension, beyond what we have here. But still, that is not to say that what's going on here is not grotesquely serious and horribly impactful to the people whose homes have been lost and those of us who are just under the stress of not knowing what's next because we have not hit containment. Now, actually, I got this from more than one of my listeners who wrote in through the website. Said that she was concerned to find out, was there any danger to a nuclear reactor from this fire? At this point, the only nuclear reactor within target distance would be San Onofre, which is not active now, but it does have the spent fuel in canisters that are not the most secure things around. My assumption would be that a working nuclear reactor would be hardened to the point where Just a regular fire wouldn't be a problem. But then there's the problem of the spent fuel pools, which are much more exposed and are not in hardened structures. And I'm wondering if you could speak to what the danger would be. And again, I'm not saying that danger exists here in Southern California. San Onofre is about 70 miles away. It's not an active reactor anymore. It's just got the waste. But if there would be a wildfire that bore down on an active nuclear reactor, what would be the impact on the reactor and, more specifically, the spent fuel pools?
It depends on how rapidly emergency help could come to the reactor. So this is another aspect of the nuclear attack, which is very different from the terrible fires that are going on right now. When the impact of a fire, of a, let's say, a nuclear attack on Los Angeles, which is, as you know, a very big target.
I live just 7 miles away from Jet Propulsion Laboratories, NASA, so this would be a ground zero as well.
So the magnitude of the impact would affect the ability of emergency services to help in all kinds of ways. So if you have 100,000 acre mass fire, this is burning down hospitals, it's destroying communication systems, it's destroying fuel supplies, pipelines, administration, property records, the operation of government. And so I would say, lingering on this just a minute, that affects the prospects of survival for the people who are just wounded, who are exposed to radiation in the fallout. It affects the supply chains for the grocery stores. It affects medicine supply, everything. Where the transportation network is destroyed, the servers, any servers which are there that can't be patched in from afar, they're gone. So modern life is fragile. And because of the way we've set it up, when you reach a disaster of that magnitude, then recovery and the long-term effects are even greater than, they're more than proportional by the area burned. So coming back to the nuclear reactor, if the operator of the reactor or the spent fuel pool and the stored fuel on site has kept the vegetation down, they're not surrounded by trees, and these casks, although they are not the greatest casks, they're warm, they're used to being warm, and they are steel, and if they get raised to another few degrees, they're not going to matter that much. However, the reactor needs a power supply. If they're operating, the power supply has to be intact, because you can't just shut it down and shut the cooling system off. And the spent fuel pool has to be cooled if there is one. Otherwise, it will boil away. And then we'll have exposed spent fuel, which will catch fire, most likely. And we'll have a Fukushima. Even when they're shut down, nuclear reactors have to be babied. They have to be supported by the rest of society. And if the rest of society can't do that, then crises develop over time, depending on the situation. So it's not direct, it's not heat, it's the loss of the power lines, the substations, and so forth.
And of course, as we learned from the Woolsey fire, there's also the problem if radioactive materials were not disposed of and stored properly, they can be what's called re-aerosolized. They can be put into the smoke and into the air and spread. And there was no follow-up on this from the government, but the citizens group, Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab, helped to fund a limited but still important study that was done by Arne Gundersen and Fair Winds Energy Education and Marco Kaltoffen at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And they analyzed samples of dusts that were taken immediately after the Woolsey fire. And plutonium was found as far as Woodland Hills, which was 9 point something miles away from the site where it originated. So the radioactive material that might exist in the environment in a semi-stable, at least it's in the ground, can be reactivated and respread by an incident such as a massive fire, such as the one we're dealing with right now in Southern California.
As well as toxic materials, which are otherwise would normally be safely stored, but they wouldn't be safe in a nuclear firestorm. And nothing is safe. Another thing which should be mentioned, I mean, obviously, we can't have this happen. I personally believe, and I've never done any sort of detailed analysis of this myself. It was done by some other people during the Cold War in the 80s, Kostatsipas, and I believe that there are classified studies of all this. I'm sure there are. And the United States cannot really withstand very many events like that. So the question is, how many nuclear bombs would destroy the entire fabric of society and government in the United States, the economic life of the country? So these fires in Los Angeles are going to have a tremendous effect going forward. And a nuclear attack would have even greater, much greater effects, just one bomb. So we can't have that kind of war. We can't have this happen. And let me, to make it worse, let me mention that, as your listeners probably know, Russia has autonomous robotic intercontinental high-speed nuclear-powered torpedoes, which have nuclear explosives. These are deployed and they could be sent anywhere. They go very deep in the ocean, and the ex nuclear explosive power is as large as you would want because they're very large. They are carried externally on a submarine. They're called the Poseidon Project or Status 6, and it was originally a Sakharov idea. And Russia started working on them when we said we are leaving the anti-ballistic missile treaty so we can develop more effective ways to shoot down incoming ballistic missiles. And Russia said, well, we can't afford this. We don't think it'll work. It might work. Maybe, you guys have zillions of dollars. Maybe you'll make it work. But we can't afford to have no nuclear deterrent. And so we're going to make a weapon which you can't shoot down. So they did, and they have these torpedoes, and I believe they have a base in Vladivostok, which would hazard the Pacific coast of the US should they want to. So you could, if you like, analyze the effect of one of these. Let's say it went off in Long Beach Harbor, and let's say it had a yield of 50 megatons. Then that would wipe out the entire LA basin, pretty much. And I didn't understand at first until Dr. Ted Postol explained what the effects of this would be, that the fact that they're slightly underwater when they detonate makes no difference at all. And so it's the same as if it were an explosion at the surface. And so it would be a gigantic fireball. And it would burn up 1 million acres on land. And the fireball will go that far out in the ocean too, but 1 million acres of Los Angeles. And the fallout would go, the deadly fallout would go as far as Arizona to Flagstaff.
If it would even get the chance to do that. I recently worked up the courage and finally read Annie Jacobson's book, Nuclear War, A Scenario, which is flat out terrifying, but she's such a good storyteller and she works the details so well that it's compulsive reading. You almost can't put it down except to go out, touch earth, and maybe give a couple of prayers. But she pointed out that even one would set off a chain of responses that probably could not be stopped. And so all it would take is one explosion somewhere to trigger all the rest of them. And there goes life on Earth. There goes the planet, which is not something that we are facing immediately here in Southern California with the wildfires, but it all seems to be connected in the. It's not just that we're playing with fire, we're getting burned by the fire, and there are worse fires on the horizon that could come to us, especially nuclear ones, if something is not done to rein in the problems now. If you had any measure of control or influence or power in this situation to say, this is what we need to do now, what would that be?
First, don't base nuclear weapons in new places abroad, especially Eastern Europe. Wind down the funding for the nuclear weapons establishment fairly quickly. Ask Mr. Musk and Mr. Ramaswamy to consider just how wasteful this is. And this is definitely a part of the US government that is quite out of control, not subject to democratic oversight. It makes its own rules. It's a separate sovereignty. As a lawyer back at the very beginning of the Atomic Energy Commission said, it was a separate sovereignty. It had its own airplanes, its own security force, and it could bring an end to all other sovereignties. And so we have to rein it in, and we have to find ways. So it's both the deep state, the administrative state, and the shallow state, which refers to the various companies which are gain their livelihood from the business, that aren't formally part of government, but they are joined at the hip. We more than doubled the number of employees making nuclear weapons in the United States so far in this century, from 25,000 to 60,000. And we're going to spend $44 billion in the effort to reacquire the capability to manufacture new plutonium warhead cores. It's with two separate factories, one which is temporary and two and small, and the other which is late, which would come later and be larger. We're making everything all new. New ICBMs, new submarines, new bombers, new cruise missiles. It's as if it's Christmas time every day of the year for them. So pick something and cut the crap out of it. Cut the heart out of it.
Greg, you have been very forthcoming during this interview, and we've ranged over subjects that I did not anticipate when we first started this. But I appreciate the thoroughness and that perhaps we can use the current and ongoing horror of this massive wildfire in Southern California to be a warning not just about line fires on the ground, but also about what it would mean if there were a fire at a nuclear facility, at spent fuel pools, at the burn pits, or worse. You've raised our awareness, and perhaps we can find a way to move forward from this that will ultimately make us safer. Though right now, my main safety is watching where that evacuation line is and whether I need to jump into the car with my dog or not.
May I say one more thing? We've got to get along with other people. We can't be making enemies all over the planet and think that we control these powers of destruction. We can start wars, run proxy wars, bomb here, bomb there. We're very vulnerable, and we need to realize that we're not in the world's driver's seat anymore. And it's very common in history for empires to have overestimated their ability to control events toward the end of their lifespan. And that's where we are. And we have got to stop squandering money on a defense establishment that is bent on trying to prevail in every continent when we can't even fight a fire in Los Angeles. We can't keep water in the fire hydrants. We're not properly taking care of people here.
A profound thought and an accurate one, I believe, being in the middle of it here. Greg Mello, I want to thank you so much for your insights, for bringing us into an expanded vision of fire and nukes, and for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby, very much. Stay safe.
Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group. We'll continue with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat special, Nukes and Fire, in just a moment. But first, Nuclear Hot Seat specializes exclusively in stories about nuclear in all its many forms. With the massive, devastating California wildfires still burning and total containment at less than 50%, there was no doubt about how this week's program would be focused. While mainstream media is doing an excellent job covering the more expected issues caused by the ongoing fires, we look to find the nuclear angle and then let you know what we've discovered. This week's show ranges far more widely than anticipated, pointing out the difference between the dangers posed by line fires, such as we have here in Los Angeles, and a mass fire such as would result from a nuclear explosion, where and how fire could break out at nuclear reactors and what the impact might be, how a standard feature on Southern California Edison's transmission towers may have contributed to sparking the Eaton fire, and more. We rely on experts whose information is footnoted and verified. They report on nuclear vulnerability to fire, including what the mainstream media has not been covering. It's not a pretty picture, but it's accurate and must be considered. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat is here, to bring you the nuclear news you won't find elsewhere. Every week, except last week, when we were without power, without internet, and in the middle of a firestorm that had evacuation set for less than 1 mile from my home, production just wasn't possible, you get it? But for 13 and a half years, we've been bringing you 1 hour a week of nuclear news, interviews with verifiable experts, nuclear history, stories of heroes and sheroes, and presenting everything we can to keep those who oppose nuclear in good heart. If you appreciate having access to this kind of information from reliable sources every week, help Nuclear Hot Seat now. Your donation is tax deductible, be it one time of any amount, or as a sustaining member for as little as $5 a month, the same as a cup of coffee and a tip to the barista here in the U.S. So how about buying Nuclear Hot Seat that metaphoric monthly cup of coffee? It's easy to set up. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, follow the prompts. Or you can send money through Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Know that whatever you can do to help, you are making a difference to the show and to the world. And that, as always, I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now here's the continuation of our Nuclear Hot Seat special, Nukes and Fire. Linda Pence Gunter makes the wildfire climate change connection with political ramifications as she asks, what if there'd be a nuclear power plant caught up in the LA fires? It's this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
Few of us can have missed seeing the horrifying images from Los Angeles this past week or so. The fires that have destroyed entire communities continue to burn. They were fanned by winds of unprecedented force, and the city was not ready to cope. Water ran out, firefighting personnel were too few. Inevitably, fingers of blame are being pointed in multiple directions, but their targets, city and county officials, political parties, are too close, too minor. The real blame lies squarely in one corner, the massive, profit-hungry, climate-denying fossil fuel companies and the governments who do their bidding and continue to enrich them at an incalculable cost to all of us, our future. It's the climate change, stupid, but you won't hear too many people saying that out loud. In the midst of this catastrophe, there are a few things to be thankful for, very few. On a personal level, we were all glad that our LA-based host, Libby Halevi, and her indispensable sidekick, Munchkin, remain safe and in their own home for now. We can be relieved, if amazed, that the death toll so far has been far lower than we might expect given the ferocity of the fires. And most of all, we can be glad that no nuclear power plant was in the path of these fires. There are two not that far away, however, Diablo Canyon to the north, still operating, and San Onofre to the south, now closed. What if... Well, it hardly bears thinking about, which is why it may come as no surprise that our safety regulator, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, doesn't much. The NRC insists that the probability of fire harming or destroying a nuclear power plant or even the radioactive waste casks stored on site is low. There are plenty of protections in place, the agency insists. It may also come as no surprise to learn that, according to the Government Accountability Office, Diablo Canyon and San Onofre are both at high or even very high risk from wildfires. In a report issued last April, the GAO reprimanded the NRC for its cavalier attitude toward the impact of the climate crisis on nuclear power plant safety. And, said the GAO, California is by no means the only place where wildfires have a strong chance of breaking out and threatening nuclear plants. According to our analysis of U.S. Forest Service and NRC data, about 20% of nuclear power plants, 16 of 75, are located in areas with a high or very high potential for wildfire, the GAO report said. More specifically, more than one-third of nuclear power plants in the South, 9 of 25, and West, 3 of 8, are located in areas with a high or very high potential for wildfire. What would happen if there was a fire at a nuclear power plant? Wrote Dave Lockbaum in 2017, a nuclear engineer formerly with the Union of Concerned Scientists, "A fire at a nuclear reactor is serious business. There are many ways to trigger a nuclear accident leading to damage of the reactor core, which can result in the release of radiation. But according to a senior manager at the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission, for a typical nuclear reactor, roughly half the risk that the reactor core will be damaged is due to the risk of fire. In other words, the odds that a fire will cause an accident leading to core damage equals that from all other causes combined. And that risk estimate assumes the fire protection regulations are being met," Lockbaum wrote. Which, of course, at many reactor sites, they are not. And those fire protection plans are mainly to prepare for things like electrical fires within the plant, not a raging inferno outside bearing down on the entire reactor site. Here are some of the things that could happen to a nuclear power plant caught up in a conflagration like the ones we are seeing in LA. Direct heat could damage vital components such as cables, control panels, and cooling water pipes, potentially disrupting plant operations and safety functions. Smoke and ash could clog air intakes, impacting cooling systems and potentially causing equipment malfunctions. Wildfires can lead to power grid outages, which could affect the plant's ability to maintain necessary power levels for safe operation. And wildfires can block access roads to the plant, hindering emergency response efforts. We've seen wildfires around nuclear sites before, of course. In 2000, a wildfire burned more than 193 acres at the sprawling Hanford Nuclear Weapons Complex, one of the most radioactive places on Earth. The Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico, home to the Manhattan Project, also experienced a fire in 2000, which came within a half mile of the property. At the Santa Susana Field Laboratory in Southern California, a 2018 wildfire burned 80% of the site. And just last year, the largest wildfire in Texas history crept within 3 miles of the Pantex nuclear weapons facility, where 14,000 plutonium pits are stored. It's going to take a long time for the areas burned in LA to recover. But if a nuclear plant had burnt there too, recovery might have been impossible for the foreseeable future, if ever. That should be warning enough not to proceed further with nuclear power in any form and instead move expeditiously to close reactors, starting with those directly and literally in the line of fire. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's very hot story.
To learn more about general nuclear reactor safety problems in the face of fire, and some specifics on how negligence by Southern California Edison may have contributed, if not caused, the Eaton fire in Altadena, Pasadena. And here a disclaimer, this is speculation only at this point, but it does involve some new information. To learn all that, I spoke with Donna Gilmore. She is founder of SanOnofreSafety.org, a public resource for factual information about the serious safety issues with the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station. I spoke with Donna Gilmore on Tuesday, January 14, 2025.
You have run San Onofre Safety now for years, if not decades, and you're very familiar with wildfire conditions as they can impact a nuclear reactor. What were you starting on before? Let me just lead you into it. So what was the first question? Fire seems to be an ever increasing risk around nuclear reactors, certainly here in California, but we're not the only place. What are some of the problems that you have seen regarding what reactors face from fire, wildfire?
Well, you know, it would be similar to any other fire in terms of the initiator of the fire. Let's just start with what initiates a fire, because if you don't have an initiator, guess what? You don't have a fire, all right? And it's by reading California Public Utility Commission data that I learned this. It's not being reported in any news that I've read. There's something called a circuit recloser, an automatic recloser. This has caused most of the big fires in California. A circuit recloser is on the transmission lines. Probably if you had a transmission line outside your house, you'd see one. It looks like a space circle or ears or something. And what that does is if, say, for example, a tree branch falls on the line, this recloser will keep restarting electricity on that line.
Oh.
The utilities call it a trip saver because it might be okay and they don't have to send a worker out and check the line. And the Public Utility Commission in California knows about this, and yet they continue to allow these reclosers in fire territory. It's crazy. I mean, in Australia, they did this, and 119 people died from that fire, and their commission determined it was from these automatic reclosers.
Now, the power lines certainly were blamed in the Woolsey fire, which took place a few years ago on the grounds of the Santa Susana Field Lab. And now the investigation as to what started, certainly the fire in Altadena, the Eaton fire, has focused on footage that they have of the fire first sparking around one of these transmission
towers. Well, these reclosers actually cause sparking also. They cause sparking. And in Lahaina, they had live wires on the ground. Now, let me compare a circuit recloser because it's kind of an unusual term. In your house, you don't worry about plugging too many things in because you know the circuit will stop and turn off the power so you don't burn your house down. This would be like having something where you plug in all your appliances and it keeps the line active and burns down your house. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. It's just crazy that they're allowing utility companies to use these things. And I don't know what year they started using them, but it's caused numerous fires in California, but it doesn't seem to make the news. I've seen it in San Francisco Chronicle years ago. I have articles and things, but this is a very important thing because as soon as something hit the branch and called a line fault, if that should have broke the circuit and they shouldn't be closing the circuit so it goes live again. So that's a huge part of the problem here. And it would stop a lot of the fires.
What is the actual danger to a nuclear facility from a fire such as the one we have here?
Well, you know, you have an operating reactor. It could shut it down. Then you have the problem of if no one can be in the area trying to keep the fuel cool, if it's in a pool. Those are the kind of things that happen. And the thing about nuclear, and this is, I'm kind of going to divert here a little bit. The dry storage system that is the standard in the United States and not elsewhere, they use containers to store the nuclear waste that actually doesn't contain gamma radiation. It goes right out these air vents that they have in these concrete structures that hold these thin canisters. And the NRC and the utility companies are not measuring all this radiation that's coming out of these air vents. The nuclear industry and the NRC refer to this as streaming radiation. Their words, not mine. And how they use this in the documentation is, how are you reducing the amount of streaming radiation coming out of the air vents? You know, you can't see, smell radiation. So we have an emergency situation right now all over the country because the utilities, with NRC being, Nuclear Regulatory Commission being complicit, they have chose to use these thin wall canister design. The rest of the world uses these thick wall metal casts that don't release the radiation. In addition to continuous streaming 24/7 of radiation out the air vents, there's neutron radiation that doesn't get stopped by the canister wall. It actually turns any water that goes around the canister. It's in a concrete structure with air vents, and air circulates around it to keep the fuel cool. When it does that, neutrons bombard the water or fog and turned it into radioactive fog, radioactive water. So these canisters not only release gamma radiation, which is lethal, it actually creates new radiation. It creates tritium, which is radioactive water. It creates carbon-14, which is radioactive carbon. Any carbon particles, which is the building block of life that flow through these air vents, they get bombarded with neutrons, turning carbon into radioactive carbon. The NRC knows this. Edison knows this. It's a huge cover-up.
This exists even without there being a fire.
You don't have to have a fire. If you use the thin wall canister design, which the NRC approves by ignoring their minimum standards, they give them exemptions to please the nuclear industry. We have a captured government agency that nobody's talking about outside of the nuclear folks.
So with this being the standard difficulty problem that exists with these canisters, how can that be influenced and undoubtedly made worse if there is a fire in the area?
Well, I moved away from San Clemente. I lived 5 miles from San Onofre. And I've worked for years with other people trying to get them to stop using these unsafe canisters that are releasing radiation and creating radiation. But I was not successful at making that happen. The only solution that's available is to start using the thick wall metal casts like they use most everywhere else that aren't going to be releasing radiation. I mean, people living down in Southern California near that plant, they're living in a radioactive stew. And because you can't see it or smell it, people just kind of put their filters on, or do they just don't want to face that reality? In terms of the fires, you've got Malibu, which is close enough to Santa Susana, which is it was a reactor meltdown that was covered up for 20 years. And that radiation, it goes in the ground, in the plants, in the water. And every time they have a fire that affects Malibu, they're spreading that radiation from that Santa Susana plant.
What are some of the other dangers that might happen if a wildfire such as we're having here in Los Angeles were to bear down on a nuclear reactor, be it San Onofre, Diablo Canyon, or any other nuclear facility in the country?
Yeah, at San Onofre, they were worried about that, and they're relying on, I think, Camp Pendleton to do something. I don't know what they could do. They're really isn't anything they could really do. And then you need to have an evacuation. And in Southern California, down where San Onofre is located, there's very little ways to get in and out of there. As it is, we have heavy traffic 7 days a week already. And you try and take everybody in their houses to get out. You really need a boat or something to go that direction. The radiation and the fires are going to be going everywhere else. So they do not have an emergency plan there. There's nothing they can really do. It's like, just get out.
And is there any means of protection for those employees who are on site and are working there?
You have to have 24/7 operations, 24/7 operations at an operating nuclear plant. You can't just abandon it. If you've got a really bad fire, you may have a point where you have to abandon it. It would be one of your worst nightmares.
So if there were a fire such as we're having here in Southern California that is bearing down on, say, an operating nuclear reactor, such as the one at Diablo Canyon or any of the others in the country, what would be the risk to the people on site working there, and what would be done about them? Would they be able to get out? Would they be stuck there? Would they be safe?
It would just depend on the situation and how bad the fire was. And at some point, they're going to be risking their lives. And there's a lot of different things with an operating reactor that the fire could cause that reactor to have to immediately shut down. And that can only last for so long. So you've got a really scary situation. I also have to just mention that every operating nuclear reactor, and this is never gets reported in the media, every operating reactor has to release radiation all the time just to operate. And with all these discussions about, oh, we could have a Fukushima or we could have a Chernobyl. Hey, it's releasing lethal radiation all the time just to operate normally. That is something that really needs to get covered. People need to know they're putting their children at risk. It's known to cause childhood leukemia from operating reactors. We've got peer-reviewed studies that point that out, but this is being hidden from the public. So you've got a problem, and then all you're going to have, it'll just get worse with a fire. But you've got a problem even without the fire.
Anything you haven't been able to say yet that you want to add in now?
I think there's a human piece of this. What I have learned, whether it's fires or nuclear reactors or nuclear waste, there's a part of the brain in people that just wants to filter out something they don't want to face. And I've determined that this is actually, let's just take San Onofre for example. There are a lot of people down there that know the dangers. They know it's streaming radiation, but they love where they live. They can't face the idea that they would have to leave their home permanently. They can't face it. Even when people know the danger, I relate it to, let's put it this way. Let's say you have a friend and she's fallen in love with somebody where you know it's not going to end well, but you can't tell her anything, right? She's going to have to learn the hard way. She or he going to have to learn the hard way. And that part of the brain filters out things you don't want to face. And it's the people in the nuclear industry, a lot of them know the dangers, but they just filter it out because that's not what they love. That's not what they want. This is the biggest problem that I face that I haven't found a solution to. So just like with the fires, you have to have the disaster. You know it's coming. We know there was not sufficient planning and taking care of the land and the water supply, cutting the budget of the fire department, all these different things. People knew there was a fire risk there, but nobody moves because what they've got is so great, they don't want to face that. I think that may be its own study, but it's really that filtering part of our brain is probably causing a lot of our disasters indirectly.
That's a great point, Donna.
Donna Gilmore of San Onofre Safety. You can learn more at her website, sanonofresafety.org. There's no time to do justice to my interview with Professor Stephen Starr, so that will be posted as a separate bonus piece on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 707. I will also post my full story there, but the short version is, Munchkin and I and the House are fine for now. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 14, 2025. You can sign up to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week at nuclearhotseat.com. Fill in the yellow opt-in box, and every week you will get the link and a brief listing of the material in the show. If you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really and always appreciate and need your help. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat, all rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as you cite the program, website, names of the guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat reminding you, even if you don't have to evacuate, don't unpack the car. That's your weekly nuclear wake-up call, so whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.